and the box is about sort of the walls that get built around us. If we're able to break some of those down, it's a sort of a mental image about the things that limit us when it comes to taking care of ourselves. The thing that I find that's super cool about post-traumatic growth is there's the person I was, event happens, and then there's the person I get to become. And I had to come to terms with the fact that I needed help. I could do a whole bunch of things, but I could not do this. As much as I knew that talking to the therapist is important, I would give anybody that advice. For me to go was like super hard. And I said, I literally said to her, I feel like I'm sliding my man card across the table to you. And she said, you did the most courageous thing you could. You asked for help and you needed it.
Welcome to Respond Resilience, along with my co-host, Dr. Stacey Raymond and Bonnie Rumilly, LCSW EMT. I'm David Dashenker. In this episode, we'll be speaking with retired Chief John Monahan, who's a consultant for the Center for Policing Equity. And we'll be talking about mental health, well-being, post-traumatic growth, recovery, and equity. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Respond Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness, Inc., and Responder TV. bbsradio.com, all the podcast platforms, and please visit our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with John after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Responder Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashenger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Rumilly, LCSW EMTB.
Today we're joined by John Monahan. He's a retired police chief with over 20 years in law enforcement. He worked as a municipal officer, state trooper, and police chief in New Hampshire. And after retiring, John consulted and facilitated focus groups and educational workshops in equity, mental wellness, resilience, and organizational development. John regularly presents on wellness, social justice causes, and police community relations. And he was featured in the 2019 Nantucket Project documentary film, Inside the Box. And we'll speak some more about that. In his spare time, John enjoys riding bikes, cross-country skiing, performing comedy, and recently thought it would be a good idea to take up jiu-jitsu. John's also a consultant for the Center for Policing Equity. John, warm welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Thanks for having me on. This is great.
Well, John, I'd like to start off by asking you, you know, with your history as a municipal officer, then a state trooper, then a chief, how have all those roles contributed to the work that you're doing now?
Yeah, thanks. That's a good question. It's funny. I got into law enforcement because I lived in very rural northern New Hampshire, and I had a small child, and I was like, God, I got to get a job that pays decent and has benefits, because I was sort of logging and doing some woodworking, but also training in martial arts. And I saw an ad in the paper for a police officer. This was not like I don't come from a long line of police officers. And so I was like, oh, maybe I'll just apply for this job and see if I can get it. And that's what got me into policing, which was, it was sort of a fluke in some ways, you know, and it turns out that I was pretty decent at it. So as I progressed in my career, it was a small town called Lebanon Police Department in New Hampshire, right on the Vermont border. And then I there were local troopers that worked in the area up north where I worked. Troopers cover very rural areas where there's no police department. So, you know, I saw these guys, they're very independent. They were, and I admired the work that they did. You know, they seemed to be something I would aspire to be. And so I applied to the state police and became a state trooper. And sure enough, you know, I got what was called Patrol 5 in way northern Grafton County. And so I covered 9 towns and 2 had police departments. So the other 7 towns were mine. And then I was the backup for the other 2 towns. So not the guys on the highway writing tickets as everybody's trying to go on vacation. You know, I was the cop for very, very small rural communities. And as I worked there, you know, I had sort of two develop. all this is about personal growth for me in many ways, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I had sort of two streams of things happening at the same time. How am I growing as a person personally and professionally, which led me to go to graduate school. And then also, you know, why do I keep seeing the same things happening in my patrol area over and over again, like domestic violence or gender-based violence, those types of things. And so that's sort of what cracked my head open once I sort of became good at my job, like how I could become better at my job, you know? And so how I got into organizational development work is I went to grad school, you know, and I studied leadership and management, you know, to sort of progress my career in the state police. And at the same time, I started studying about how we raise young men up. And how that affects the gender-based and domestic violence cases that I was seeing. I became fascinated with that. And so those two things, I was growing personally with my graduate school studies, and then I was growing sort of professionally in my field about trying to understand why I was seeing what I was seeing out in there, which got me into the mental health stuff. You know, how are we raising ourselves up? And those young guys become older guys, you know, and they have challenges. And so that's how I got started in all this.
Amazing journey, John. And you have documented in a couple of different ways. One is a TED Talk. That's kind of how I learned that about your work and who you are and what you do. And I highly recommend anybody watch that, because you certainly show lighter side of your career. I love the whole interview description. It's a really, really well done TED Talk. So kudos for that. And then another thing which you just shared with us is this documentary called Inside the Box. And I'd love for you to speak about the box. What is it and how does it come into play for people in law enforcement?
They have this thing called the man box. To be a man, you can't get sad. You're supposed to be the breadwinner. A few emotions maybe. My dad's a Vietnam vet. Didn't talk about it ever, ever. Didn't express a lot of emotion. In the man box, the one emotion you can express is anger. Great sense of humor, but an explosive temper, you know, and it scared the shit out of me.
Always felt kind of weak as a person. My father was my role model. That was the box that he lived in.
We have a cop box that fits inside the man box. We're supposed to be even tougher and not show any emotion. We can't fit in there.
As I talked about, the looking at how we're raising these young guys up, I started to notice that even the people I worked with and myself were struggling within policing, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I became fascinated with, like, what are we doing for mental health for law enforcement officers? And a close friend of mine, Jamie, who is in that film, who you may end up speaking with hopefully at some point, he came down with post-traumatic stress disorder. He was diagnosed with it, you know, and so as an organizational development guy, I was looking at how is his organization treating him at this time when he's struggling mentally, and should it be that way? And I read this book called Resilience by Eric Greitens. He had been a Navy SEAL, and I really didn't know much about mental health, but what I did know is that people needed battle buddies when they're struggling at times like that, and they need a path out. And that if I saw, you know, I had become a chief of police at this point, you know, I realized that my career aspirations were not headed where I wanted to in the state police. And so I became a police chief in a small town, but Jamie and I had stayed friends. And so he wasn't really getting the kind of support that he needed. And I think that the organization just really hadn't dealt with it, you know, before. So they didn't know what they were doing to the degree that maybe they needed to. So that's kind of how I got involved. It was helping a friend of mine, you know, which also helped me. And so, you know, I was looking at, you know, what are the norms around talking about mental health, and so that's my work ended up, you know, culminating in that TED Talk, where it's really about first stigma breaking, right? How do we break the stigma around being able to speak up, ask for help? It doesn't mean you're weak. We're in this tough guy profession, you know, and everybody, if I say I'm having a hard time, you know, it doesn't mean I'm going to have a hard time forever. It just means for right now. But if I say that, you know, am I now labeled as somebody who's unreliable, that people can't trust, that kind of thing. And so I was able to give the TED Talk, which I was really grateful for, you know, and hopefully spread the word a little bit more about stigma breaking, but then about what are the tools that you need once you break the stigma. And that's what got me interested in post-traumatic growth work.
Our greatest asset is a thinking, knowledgeable, well-trained, physically fit, and healthy firefighter. It is the continual drive to be better, to improve, and to never be satisfied with the status quo. Success begins long before the alarm comes in or the tones go off. Success is nothing new in the FDNY. We did not suddenly wake up one day and become good at what we do. We need enthusiastic leadership and training that has a clear understanding of what's at stake. That is teamwork. That is dedication. That is well-trained firefighters ready to go to work on game day. The time to train is now, before the incident or game day.
We've all seen the leader who's tactically proficient, but lacks the people skills for true inspirational leadership. Cornerstones of Leadership, on and off the fire ground, discusses the soft skills necessary for success, both on and off the fire ground.
In terms of the box, can you describe what that term means? Because you stated very eloquently in the film.
Yeah. So the box is this, and I'll give credit. It's Maine Boys to Men. It's this group of people that go around, you know, helping young guys learn about what it means to be a man, you know? And so all the messages that we get growing up about what does it mean to be a man, you know, it's, they call it the box, you know? And so if you wrote all those things, it's an exercise they do. They draw a box on a piece of paper and you write all those labels in there. And usually there's things like be tough, you know, play sports, don't cry, all the messages we get. And if you think about that box in terms of being a first responder, you know, when the regular guys get scared or nervous or whatever, and they need help, who do they call? Us, the police, right? And, or fire, or EMS, and we have to go and be tougher, stronger, better, more stoic, and more calm, cool, collected in those moments. And so to be outside of that box, right, breaking that stigma, it doesn't mean that all those things aren't good inside the box, but they are very limiting when it comes to our mental health and well-being. You know, it's not normal to absorb so much bad stuff in the course of our duties and not be able to have a healthy way to then process it and release it. And the box is about sort of the walls that get built around us. And so if we're able to break some of those down, you know, that's what the box, it's a sort of a mental image really about the things that limit us when it comes to taking care of ourselves.
Yeah. And John, you talk about, you know, having a healthy release. And then in that, that short film, you mentioned that anger is sort of the only route that men are given permission to release any of that. Those negative feelings, whether it's, you know, hurt or sadness, shame, grief, whatever. How do you get past the stigma? Are there any like quick tips or things that seem to break down that wall?
Yeah, it's, you know, anger, as you're probably aware, is a secondary emotion, usually, right? There's righteous anger, where something really bad happens, and it's appropriate to be angry about it. Mm-hmm. And then there is sort of anger that we use to mask things like hurt. Because anger is an empowering emotion, right? I feel it gets my adrenaline and blood pumping. Sadness is not, right? Worry is not, and fear is not.
Guilt.
All those things are not. Yeah, guilt is not, or shame, whatever it might be. They're not empowering emotions. And so anger is an easy sort of layer to place on top of those because we feel less vulnerable or weak or whatever it might be. And so being able to peel that back, you know, what I would say the first thing is being able to do it in a safe environment, you know, whether that's with a group of friends, like I have some very close friends, Doug and Jamie, who I'm able to share kind of my most vulnerable parts of me, or a therapist or somebody who you, a clergy member, whoever it might be, but it needs to be someplace safe. You know, you don't want to walk into the locker room at your beer league hockey game and be like, hey guys, I have some stuff I want to share, you know, unless they're a really good, great, trusted group of friends. And they could be, you know, but generally speaking, locker rooms aren't the best places to you know, reveal yourself.
Right. Or roll call maybe is like not a good time to do it. Right. And John, also in this film, we're talking about there is an amazing group that you put together based on watching some films about acceptance and forgiveness, and it kind of speaks to the vulnerability you're talking about. How did that group come together, and is it still in existence, and what's the dynamics of it?
Yeah, so you know, the film was made about us watching a film, and the film was about acceptance, you know, and so the Nantucket Project makes films of meaning is what they would call it, and then they use those films to help people gather and foster conversations that would never happen usually otherwise, and so Doug, Jamie, and I are the group, and we're still friends to this day. Jamie has moved to Colorado, so I see him virtually, you know, and call him on the phone. And Doug and I are actually going to go to the Nantucket Project gathering in a couple weeks on the island of Nantucket. Well, they won't probably play this film at that. They could, I don't know, you know, but there'll be some big name speakers there, you know, talking about the topic this year is pluralism. How do you take multiple views, you know, and have a meaningful conversation that then enhances everybody's ability to understand and navigate challenging issues in a way that's positive, which we don't normally see. So, you know, they're still doing great work. And so Doug and I still teach together. So we will be teaching at Roger Williams University, their command school, this Friday. We teach a mental health class based on that film, The Box. And so we'll be doing that down there, down in Rhode Island. It's part of Roger Williams command school is a subset of their criminal justice program.
Well, John, you've had your own recovery journey with regard to alcohol. Can you speak about that and then put it in terms of your post-traumatic growth?
Yeah, sure, I can. It, you know, I didn't get sober till after I retired, and I thought I was a problem drinker. You know, somebody told me that term once, and it was like I was like, that's the best thing I've ever heard, right? Like, because now I can sort of put off the need to face this issue that I have. I wasn't like a drinker who would get up and drink. You know, I never drank on duty or at work or anything like that. But boy, every night it was cocktail hour at my house, and I thought because I'm a police chief. I've got, you know, some employees who are difficult, some citizens who are difficult, some, you know, governing bodies that can be difficult. I had problems. I've seen a lot of horrible things. As I was a working chief is what they called us. So, you know, I could be at a fatal accident and then a select board meeting that evening, you know, and, you know, and then the next day dealing with a union grievance or something. So it was a very stressful career for sure, you know, and I used alcohol as a coping mechanism. And so, so even in this film, you know, I'm helping Jamie and Doug, but I still had my own issue with alcohol, you know, and then I retired and I fully expected like less stress, less drinking. And that's just not how alcoholism works, as I found out. So, you know, with more time on my hands, I was like, well, I guess I can drink at 4 instead of 5. And I was baffled by it because I'm a pretty successful person, right? Like there's a lot of stigma around saying I'm an alcoholic, because, you know, in my family, at least I'm a good Irish Catholic kid from Massachusetts, you know, they're like, you know, get on the wagon, Johnny, you know, And so saying that out loud, a lot of people think of, you know, the guy with the paper bag living under a bridge. And so admitting this thing that I had this fault, regardless of everything I've achieved in my life, was hard. And I had to come to terms with the fact that I needed help and I couldn't do it, right? I could do a whole bunch of things, but I could not do this, you know? And so I had to go, I went to AA, I went to a recovery meeting and I still am in recovery today. Because it's a practice, right? It's not just something that you do one and done. Right. And that's the way mental health is too, you know? Mm-hmm. And so despite my knowing a lot about mental health, I still had my own struggles. And the biggest thing I learned is that fixing my own issues with it helps me to show up in much bigger ways for people in my life, the people that I love and care about, you know, more than I ever could before, you know, more than I ever could before. So some of the things that I wasn't able to do before was like ask for help. Like I wanted to be the strong one And so, in even though I had Jamie and Doug as my friends, I wanted to be the guy to help them. And it was very hard for me to ask them to help me. It was very hard for me to accept help. And I think that is a challenge for a lot of first responders.
Absolutely.
Where the guy's in charge or the gal's in charge, to say, I don't got this. I need something more than me. And the other part, that something more than me, is a spiritual aspect to it, you know, and I was raised, again, you know, Irish Catholic. And so my relationship with the church was not a strong one, once I was out of it. And so, you know, recovery gives you an opportunity to recreate a relationship with something spiritual. Some people call it a higher power, you know, and so being able to understand that there is something greater than me that can help me through difficult times was really important to learn. And, you know, when they do studies on POWs, that they find that the guys who were able to survive those camps were people who had this faith that something greater than themselves would help, whether it was a team of special op guys that were coming to get them, or, you know, God or whomever you want to call it. So you know, there were some pieces missing in my in my wellness kit, and really, so for me, when we talk about post-traumatic growth, it gave me the opportunity to complete that, and I was able to grow from it, from a guy that you know, can show up in bigger, better ways to help other people. So that I can get more into it if you'd like, but that is briefly kind of my recovery journey. You know, my larger post-traumatic growth journey is tied to that as well.
When our nation and communities around the world experience catastrophes and chaos, turn to Edie Darling, Ambassador of Peace. Exuding faith, providing hope, and sharing God's love through these challenging times, she brings healing solutions and meaningful dialogue. She heals communities by building a foundation of mutual respect and trust, working collaboratively at a round table of peace. Allow Edie Darling, Ambassador of Peace, to guide the way.
I'd love to get your perspective, John, as a leader, how all those came into play, your new toolkit, your new perspective, maybe your new connection spiritually. Like, how did that change the game for you as a chief?
Yeah. So again, I didn't get sober till after I retired. So at the time, you know, it was all me. Like, I was like, pile it on. There's nothing this guy can't handle or carry. Mm-hmm. And as I said in my TED talk, you know, that's like pebbles in a backpack. And after a while, that thing weighs a ton. And at some point you hit a breaking point. And for me, I hit mine. I was like, I'm done, 20 plus years. And I went and I saw a therapist, you know, and I was like, listen, I think I'm done here. I'm really crashing. And I said, even coming to see you, as much as I knew that talking to a therapist is important, I would give anybody that advice, for me to go was like super hard. And I said, I literally said to her, I feel like I'm sliding my man card across the table to you. And she said, you did the most courageous thing you could. You asked for help when you needed it. Right. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of the beginning for me, you know? And so, you know, it's funny, this, I talked to this, older Jewish lady who's a reformed, she calls herself a reformed Jew, and she's Buddhist now. And so she says, I wrestle with this higher power thing. And she said, anytime I'm able to accomplish something that I can't do for myself, I know that is a power greater than myself helping me. And so I love that phrasing, because it kind of like opens the door for folks, and you can walk through and make your relationship whatever you want it to be, you know? So I don't know if I answered your question or not.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what you're saying is, it kind of takes a humbleness, right? Yeah. That we can't just handle all of our problems and let it just keep piling on just by ourselves. We do need other people. And that is particularly hard for first responders. And the other piece is this concept of vulnerability, which has like a really, it seems negative, but to have the courage to be vulnerable, to say, I've got an issue and I need to talk to somebody about it, is really a strength.
Yes, it is. I you know, it's funny. I did this comedy bit, and I evoked the name of Her Holiness Brené Brown. If you're familiar with her,
yes, I am.
She's the bomb great. When it comes to, like, you know, shame and vulnerability and all that. And she gives this one of her talks, I don't know if it was a TED talk or not, but she talks about presenting to this group of like Navy SEALs or Green Berets or whatever. And they were like, I don't know about this vulnerability stuff, you know? And she tells them, when you run across a field of fire to go rescue a buddy, are you not exposed? And they're like, yes. And she's like, does that make you vulnerable? And they're like, yes. And she goes, does it take courage? And they say, yes. And so she's like, so there is no, you know, courage without vulnerability and exposure. And they're like, all right, you make a good point. So it's that kind of thing, right? Like realizing that it is a strength, right? It takes courage to do something that exposes you, you know, and I'm not afraid to do that anymore, you know. Mm-hmm. Basically everything when we really do our work boils down to fear. Like, what am I afraid of? You know, what am I afraid of? People making fun of me, belonging, worthiness, all those types of things, you know, mm-hmm. Am I going to get kicked out of this group? You know, that kind of stuff. And so how can I really, you know, find a group of people who I can be my authentic self with and not be shamed and to be able to wrestle with these things with and grow from them and really kind of put all that stuff aside, mm-hmm. and become the person you're meant to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And let's kind of shift gears into what you're doing today. Doing racial equity work with the community. And I guess policing is part of that. Can you speak to that? Like how you kind of got to this place in your life and how does it all relate to what we're talking about?
Yeah. I saw, it was like 2013 or something when the Black Lives Matter movement had started. It was prior to the George Floyd stuff that had happened in 2020. So, and I was trying to wrap my head around like, what does the slogan mean? You know? And I read this great article this guy wrote and he was just, because I was like, well, all lives are really important, you know? And he wrote this article that said, you know, if you have a broken bone in your body, that's the important bone, right? And so it's about pointing. And so all bones matter, yes, but the broken one we kind of need to pay attention to. And so it got me curious about what is equity work? What does it mean to be, you know, to stand up for folks? And I was like, well, I'm a cop. I stand up for people that need help. So, you know, and so that got me interested in this type of work. And I was able to do some training with the University of New Hampshire called Leadership Learning for Equity Exchange. And it was essentially a group of white people who went through this process of learning about racism. And I learned about things that I had no idea. They do not teach you this stuff in school. And so I was interested in that as a police chief, but also as like an organizational development guy, like how do our organizations affect some people some ways and other people other ways? And it tied exactly into our mental health stuff. What are the things that obstruct us from achieving our goals of wellness, you know? And so I started really being fascinated from two sort of standpoints, you know, how are organizations set up to benefit some and not others? And what are the things that obstruct us from achieving those goals? And I felt like as a guy who held a position of power, it was my responsibility to be involved in work of removing boundaries and barriers to people achieving the same things that I was able to achieve. So that's what got me interested in doing the equity work, you know. And I found it can be difficult and painful and challenging to learn about it. But as my friend Merle says, on the other side of that is freedom. And she is not incorrect about that at all, you know. It challenges some of our thoughts, you know, and so does the mental health stuff, right? Like we're challenging our belief systems and saying, mm-hmm. is it okay to do this? Is it okay to believe this? What if I change my beliefs on this? What does that mean? And it takes some critical thinking. It takes that emotional intelligence to manage myself in moments of discomfort. On the other side of that is freedom.
Yeah. It reminds me of stepping out of the comfort zone, right? It's kind of easy to live in that area, but it sounds like you're now embracing the opportunity to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, equity work is really about a lot of people will say like we're leveling the playing field. I don't see it that way. I see it as how do we take the tops off of stuff so people can really all grow to their full potential? You know, that's how I view equity work. And I had one of my early bosses, this woman, Atia, said to me, you know, racism is harmful to white people too. And I was like, what is she talking about? And it took me a really long time to wrap my head around that. And then my friend Merle says, it's the tax that we pay for participating in a system that we didn't necessarily create or agree to. And so the more that we are able to understand the systems we work in and how they negatively affect us and be able to do something about it, the better off we all will be. And so that's what she meant, you know, is that even though you may think you're benefiting from something, let's say you're a captain in a police department, you know, and you, and this is, I'm not talking about equity now, I'm talking about mental health. You've risen to the highest of ranks, you know, or close to, and you, but you've got this stigma stuff, right? It's a tax you are paying to, even though people would say you're successful, if you're still struggling in your relationships with your kids, your spouse, you know, your coworkers, you know, until you can break that stigma, it's a tax you're going to pay for not challenging these belief systems that limit us. So
cool stuff.
And, what can you give us some examples of challenging the beliefs that keep racial inequity in place?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, in police work, it's really, it boils down to things like, police are available 24/7, right? And so unfortunately, 365 days a year, much of what we deal with isn't necessarily our job, but because we're the only ones around 24/7, 365, we get it. And so a lot of times it's things that we would refer to as like nuisance crimes. And the root of those are things like mental health and substance abuse and unhoused, you know, that are just kind of manifesting in these crimes of annoyance for, mm-hmm. for the people in the community. And so the police get called to those, but are they really the best ones to deal with it, you know? And so our work at CPE is really around collecting data to see, you know, what are their disparities in how we're deploying our police services, you know, to certain places, to see, do we need mental health in this particular neighborhood because they don't have enough? And this is where we're seeing a spike in use of force, not because, you know, they're prejudiced. It's only because it's an under-resourced area and we need to provide more resources there. And then in fact, we see, you know, the mental health issues being addressed and the uses of force is going down, you know? So it's really about discovering what are good co-responder models, what are alternative response models, what are resources that are needed that have gone unmet in areas. And so that's what kind of equity work in policing is looks like. And I think it's good for police because then you are not going to deal with as many hard things as you used to. And so, you know, you're able to do the more positive aspects of your job, you know, engage with community and fun in more positive ways. And so to me, it's a win-win. You know, it keeps us mentally healthy. And as I said in my TED talk, you know, public health is part of it is having healthy first responders, you know. And so the healthier your first responders are going to be, the healthier, you know, your community is going to be. So it's a win-win in my opinion.
Really powerful stuff, I think, for police organizations to understand. We don't have to tear everything down. And if we focus on the most important job, the most important position is the chief of police, and we get that hire right, everything else takes care of itself. It really does. Organizational culture. I think if we change that, matter of fact, I know we change that, we're going to see cops come back. We're absolutely going to see cops come back. We're not going to have people, good people left to do this job as hard as it is, but we now create cultures where we don't even value them or we don't appreciate them. Hopefully a lot of leaders that read this book and say, you know what? I need to get into therapy. I need to talk to somebody. I need to get a coach. I need to freaking figure out who I am. I just hope that happens because you'd be welcome to join the club because we're all in this thing together.
I'd love to switch gears into this. We've had another police chief on our show, David Ogden from Windermere, Florida, and he's a big Brazilian jiu-jitsu guy.
Yeah.
So speak about jiu-jitsu in your life. What role does it play? Like, what does it mean to you, and what's jiu-jitsu about for you?
Yeah, you know, I had trained in martial arts a really long time ago, and I loved it. And then I got so busy with kids and work and stuff, I just sort of let it go. And so once I retired and the pandemic kind of subsided, I was like, I think I want to train again, you know? And so, and I had moved. So there's this mixed martial arts school. It's called Nostos. It's a couple towns over. The guy who runs it, Devin, is a former UFC fighter. And he's a third or fourth degree black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And so I would go there. I was a good stand-up fighter. You know, I could do Muay Thai and that kind of thing. And when we would spar, because it's an MMA school, there was grappling involved. And I was like a small child being mauled by a grizzly bear. It was terrible. And so I was like, I can't keep getting my butt kicked like this. So I was like, I got to start training in jiu-jitsu, you know? And so I did. So I started training in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And it, for as much as I knew about martial arts in my past, you know, I'm highly ranked in a couple of different martial arts. It was like, I knew nothing. So it was interesting to be a beginner again. You know, and what I've learned so far is that it is where most arts are about positioning and striking and pushing people away. This is one that's sort of mentally counterintuitive. You're pulling people towards you and embracing them. I have a good friend that says it's like folding clothes, but the people are still wearing them. You know, I end up training with a lot of people who are a lot younger than me. And so it's fun, you know, and I enjoy it. It keeps me in good shape. The other thing is that it is a game of inches and millimeters, and it's a game of patience, and it's a game of challenging. And so I actually found this book called Trauma for Jiu-Jitsu, or Jiu-Jitsu for Trauma. And it's about how you can use jiu-jitsu, just like you would use yoga or equine therapy or those types of things, as a healing practice, you know, because as we know, trauma enters kind of through the body, and then our brain tells us a story about it. And so the pathway out a lot of times is through physical activities, where we can reprogram our brain when they're in, challenging but overcoming circumstances. And so for me, my focus on jiu-jitsu has really been about how can I put myself in challenging situations and be successful in them. You know, maybe I win, maybe I lose, but how do I reprogram my brain so that I have a different relationship in these challenging moments? And so really, you know, with my work in post-traumatic growth, I very much am focused on how do I use this art of jiu-jitsu to, you know, to help people put themselves in situations where they get challenged and they get to rewrite the story of what challenge means to them in their brain. So I love it. It's great. It's fascinating. I am a two-stripe white belt, you know, which is not a really big deal, but I've been training about 8 months and I really enjoy it. It's good. It's good therapy.
Well, if you think about it, none of us grows unless we are challenged. Right. You have to go to the edge of your comfort zone if you're going to gain anything. So,
yeah, you do. You know, it's interesting. I was doing a lot of research on trauma. I work a little bit for an organization called Boulder Crest on the side. And so they define trauma as when your core values are challenged to the degree that your coping mechanisms are overwhelmed, you know, and then I was taking some other training, and these guys described trauma as this is how they described it. So that core value moment is like you're stepping on a tack, right? And your body experiences the pain, and then your brain makes sense of it after, you know. Or you're playing tennis and you hurt your knee, but you love tennis, so your brain tells you, "Oh, I have to heal from this." Versus the same injury in a car accident can be severely traumatizing. Same injury, different mental story, you know. So how do we put ourselves into situations where we have the opportunity to feel physically challenged, and then start to rewrite some of those stories, which are kind of fear-based or whatever they might be, you know. So I'm all about, what do we need to do to build resilience for people? You know, what are the guardrails of life that kind of keep us from falling in the ditch? You know, and then what are therapies we can do, even if we've gone off the road and we get pulled back on, we do some good therapy work, you know, what are some things that we can do to kind of build ourselves back up so that we're running at full speed again. And I find, you know, jiu-jitsu, other people find yoga, other people do, you know, equine therapy. There's a lot of art therapy, lots of therapies out there that help us get back.
All right.
Well, absolutely. John, we've covered a lot in a short amount of time. I would love to just have you share where people can find you, any other events or offerings you have going on that you'd like to talk about.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're a first responder, go to the Roger Williams Command School and you'll get to meet us there. I'm on social media. I'm just John Monahan III, just like my name says, for the podcast here. And I'm usually wearing some sort of stupid outfit because I'll be on stage doing comedy in most of the photographs that you'll see of me. And if you want to see my comedy, you can find it on Facebook. My TED Talk, just Google John Monahan, TED Talk policing. I think I'm the only John Monahan that's done a TED Talk. And so you can find me there. I'm on LinkedIn, and I'm happy to connect with folks, whether it's just an organization, so my interest is not just for policing, but also like organizations, and communities, that need to do some good work. So feel free to reach out. The thing that I find that's super cool about post-traumatic growth is there's the person I was, event happens, and then there's the person I get to become. And that's not limited to first responders. Communities aren't experiencing that, and organizations experience that. Organizations that go through a hard time, not the same organization afterwards. So I love to nerd out to how, we can overcome our challenges and become a better version of ourselves because of it.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you and learning more about you. And thank you for sharing all the things you've done and experienced in such an open and honest way. I think it's going to be helpful to those who hear this. So we appreciate you very much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Like and subscribe, YouTube, Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc. and Responder TV, bbsradio.com, all the podcast platforms, and go to our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.